This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
And welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. My name is Richard Serrett, and this is The Conspiracy Show. Say thanks to Victor Vigiani for sitting in last week. Did a terrific job while I was off. I took the boys fishing and camping. They're actually here with me tonight, camped out in the boardroom just down the hall from our studio here, and they've got some popcorn and a movie. So last week, fishing, camping, and Zach landed his first largemouth bass on the weekend, and North netted a few crappies. He kept calling them crabbies, but they're crappies, which a tasty little panfish. Anyway, they were very excited. I hope you're all getting a little camping and fishing in this summer, at least a chance maybe to put your feet up on the front porch or maybe read a good book. Before we get started, I want to welcome two new affiliates to The Conspiracy Show. KLBM AM in La Grande, Oregon, and KBKR AM in Baker City, Oregon. KLBM and KBKR. They're part of the same broadcast family. They're billed as Super Talk, and they serve, I believe it's Eastern Oregon. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be part of KLBM and KBKR. I think that's three or four affiliates we now have in Oregon. And I look forward to hearing from all of you listening on in Oregon. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett or through the website. You can contact me at richardserrett.com. If you haven't already done so, check out the website for the television program, The Conspiracy Show, www.theconspiracyshow.com. It's just launched. It's all set for the debut of Season 3 on Vision TV across Canada, August 11th at 10 p.m. Eastern. The website is fabulous. And I really, congratulations to everyone at Secret Location, the web design team there, Zoomer, and Jalal, my partner at Film One, for putting this fabulous website together. It's very interactive. You can debate, discuss, vote as you watch episodes throughout the season. And again, that's theconspiracyshow.com. Season 3 debuts August 11th across Canada. And we'll have an announcement, too, about a syndication and episodes available in the United States. One more thing, and then we'll get to the meat of the program. Tickets now on sale for Follow the Truth, the Conspiracy Show Summit. Very excited about this. That's Sunday, November the 16th at the Regent Theater in Oshawa. It's an all-day conference-style event. I'll be hosting six great speakers: Roswell investigator Don Schmidt, witness to the Rendlesham UFO incident, Jim Peniston, crop circle researcher, filmmaker Patty Greer, time travel with theoretical physicist Dr. Ronald Mallett, Ancient Giants in America with Emmy Award-winning writer Richard Dewhurst, Jim Elvidge, who's been with me a number of times on the program, who is the author of The Universe Solved. He's going to make a very compelling case. We're living in a digitally programmed reality. We're living in the Matrix. For more details and ticket information, go to followthetruth.tv. Sunday, November 16th, Regent Theatre, Oshawa, Ontario. Six fabulous speakers all under one roof. Hope to see you there. Follow the Truth TV. Every few weeks, it seems, I'll come across a story of an alleged demonic possession. And the vast majority of these cases seem somewhat fantastical. They're very, very difficult to corroborate, very little evidence. In some instances, no real verifiable, nothing verifiable. However, earlier in the year, there was a case reported that it stays with me because it's so chilling and it seems so authentic and genuine. It was, I don't know if you saw this, it was reported back in January of this year, and it involves a woman in Gary, Indiana, a terrified mother, really, and she claims she watched in horror as her demon-possessed 9-year-old son walked backwards up a wall and ceiling. Her claims would be pretty easy to dismiss if a child services caseworker and a nurse weren't reportedly there to witness it all. Latoya Amons claims all three of her children showed signs of being possessed, including what she called evil smiles and strangely deep voices, according to the Indianapolis Star. The mother says she also witnessed her 12-year-old daughter levitating in their Gary, Indiana home. Strangely enough, the scary-sounding incident is outlined in official documents. Further, Gary Police Chief Police Captain Charles Austin told the Indianapolis Star that he is a believer after making several visits to the home and interviewing witnesses. He first thought the family was making stories up as part of a get-rich-quick scheme. Amon's home was exorcised by a Catholic priest in a number of ceremonies that were reportedly authorized by the Diocese of Gary. The story apparently became so believable that officers with the police department said they were too scared to stay in the house, and some city officials wouldn't even step foot on the property. The 32-year-old mother says the spirits that haunted her family's house were only vanquished after she moved away and underwent several exorcisms. The unbelievable story has come to light after the Indianapolis Star obtained hundreds of pages of official documents relating to the case. So for some time, as I say, this story has stayed with me, and I've been meaning to address the issue of demonic possession and the holy rite of exorcism on the program. I've talked about possession on the program before, but I've finally been able to pull this program together and present it to you tonight. Archbishop Ron Feil is with us. He's been a Catholic priest for 34 years, and he is the chief exorcist for the Sacred Order of St. Michael the Archangel. Archbishop Feil, great pleasure to have you on The Conspiracy Show. How are you, sir?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm very much honored.
Before we proceed, I have talked with Catholic priests, several of them off the air, who have been present at exorcisms. And whenever we get into a discussion about demons and exorcism, they have always advised me that it would be in all our best interest for them to say a prayer, because whenever you talk about these things, there is the potential, I think you know where I'm going with this, Archbishop, to invite these sorts of entities into our lives. And I'm just wondering, before we proceed, would you like to say some sort of a prayer? Do you think that's advisable?
Well, you know, it's a wonderful gesture, and of course that'd be really nice, but I don't really feel it's necessary for this.
Interesting. Okay.
For this thing, I think it's a matter of what your belief system is, and I believe that when inviting the demonic into your space or into your area, you have to personally invite him. It cannot be a generalization where the demonic will just come in as a result of a conversation that we might have.
Well, that's
it
good to know.
It just doesn't work that way.
That is good to know. Well, I feel much better. Before we get started, let me, on your journey and your personal encounters with demons, let me ask you about the Gary, Indiana case. I'm assuming you're pretty familiar with that. And what do you make of it?
Actually, I think it's quite interesting. And what gives it a lot of credibility are the witnesses, the people who were present, who actually saw the young man literally walk up the wall and flip over. I believe it was the grandmother. The grandmother was still holding his hand as he was walking the wall. And present was a state social caseworker, if I'm not mistaken, and also a psychologist. And when they witnessed this, they were so shocked and terrified that they ran out of the house. They left the premises immediately and called for assistance. I believe they called security, they called the police, they called other authorities to get them involved. They were so terrified, they have never seen such a thing. And let's face it, this is something you don't see every day.
No, I had occasion while filming an episode of my TV show to travel down to Yonkers, New York, and I met a Dr. Richard Gallagher, who's a state-certified or a board-certified psychologist, who claims he also witnessed an authentic case of demonic possession. I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Gallagher. He wrote a piece for one of the Catholic publications about this case. Are you familiar with that?
Actually, I believe I am. I try to stay abreast as to what's out there. And because of our technology, I'm able to do that.
Well, in this case, I also spoke to the Catholic priest who was in attendance at the exorcisms. And again, you know, corroborating witnesses to me, and I've stated publicly on the air that I am someone who believes in the spirit world. I am an Orthodox Christian. I do believe in the spirit realm, angels and demons. Let's talk about you, Archbishop. First of all, the Sacred Order of Saint Michael the Archangel. Tell me a little bit about that order. Has it been around a long time?
Yes, actually. We've been around since 1981. We're an international organization with members in 24 countries and 15 states here in the United States. Our members consist of clergy and investigators. And we have a systematic way in doing things. So you might find that quite interesting. I can go into that now or...
Well, we'll be coming up on a break in a couple of minutes, but let me – and we can come back to exactly what the Sacred Order does and how, you know, one gets in touch with you if one is concerned about a loved one or a family member, et cetera, that may be possessed. Can I ask you about exorcism as it is sort of looked upon by the Vatican, for example? Because there was a time when I would say – just prior to Pope John Paul II, when it wasn't talked about much. I mean, it was in the movies, it was portrayed in television and so forth, but it almost seemed as if the Vatican was not embarrassed by it, but they just didn't want to talk about it. But that seems to be changing now.
There's been major changes since 1962, as you may or may not be aware of. Our jurisdiction is a pre-Vatican II Roman Catholic order. We're a traditional Roman Catholic order which practices the traditional ways. So everything prior to 1962 would be something that we have practiced and subscribe to.
All right.
So I need to clear that. I need to make that clear right now.
Okay. So you subscribe to essentially pre-Vatican II.
The pre-Vatican II.
All right, listen.
Now, this means that we, when we say the Roman ritual, it is the genuine article. It has not been revised. We say our sacraments in Latin.
All right, listen. I gotta take a timeout. Forgive me, Archbishop. We'll take a timeout. We'll come back and we'll continue to delve into demons, angels, and exorcisms with Archbishop Ron File, the chief exorcist for the Sacred Order of Saint Michael the Archangel, right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away. Archbishop Ron File is with us, chief exorcist for the Sacred Order of Saint Michael the Archangel, and the website is orderofexorcists.com. Now, Archbishop, what would you say to those who may be listening thinking, exorcism in the year 2014, my Lord, that belongs back in the Middle Ages? What would you say to them?
I would say that there are many of jurisdictions, churches, parishes, bishops, archbishops might also agree to that synopsis. However, I will tell you that that there are a great deal of ministries that are that have some form of deliverance ministry or a ministry of exorcism, which is a healing ministry. So the two coexist. In our order, we also not only believe and subscribe to the miracles and healing power of our Lord, but we also work side by side with the medical community. We have two physicians that are part of our order. We have one that's a psychiatrist, and the other one's a general practitioner. They are also in our order, and anytime we have a question in regards to validate someone's psychological profile or medical profile, a copy of the transcripts would go directly to our physicians, and they would review and will confirm that if, in fact, there is a medical or psychological condition. And if there is, we have to go one step further and look at the other reports and assessments from that are submitted by our investigators. And this would be in regards to what we refer to as outer manifestations. And these are things that occur around the person who may be a target of possession or obsession. And we also do a lot of work with demonic infestation, which we can go into in detail.
You said possession or obsession. What do you mean by obsession?
Well, demonic oppression, okay, is actually what I'm referring to, and that would be a mild to severe harassment by an evil spirit. And that would be by the resulting of from the openings of some doors to Satan's influence. Because we live in a modern world where technology is at our fingertips, there's a demonic influence all around us. And so any one of us can be a target to demonic oppression.
Now, before we talk about how some of those doors might be opened or those portals, let me just back up a moment. You mentioned that you have medical staff that work as part of your team. So you must rule out before you perform exorcisms, you must rule out any underlying mental health issues or substance abuse issues. Is that correct?
These things can also be present in a demonic a case of demonic possession. However, there has to be more. There has to be signs of physical outward manifestations that would take place along with some form of mental illness that might be present. If mental illness is the only factor that's present, then that would not be enough to support a case of demonic possession. We would have to have all the evidence. And just the medical and psychological profile is just part of the equation.
All right. Now, I mentioned the cynics or the skeptics out there. Could you think of a case? Obviously, you know, there's confidentiality issues and we can't mention names. But as best you can, present a case that you would hold up to a skeptic to show them and the world that demonic possession is real.
What we do is we have this assessment, this process, and it's done in a systematic way which would rule out any doubt in regards to any form of scenario. We have our investigators do what we refer to as a first contact interview, and we have a series of questions that are directed to the individual. Now, the individual who would be possessed would not be in the position to answer these questions, so we would probably direct these questions to someone in the household, like a mother or father or brother or sister, someone who shares the household and as a result could give us accurate answers as to what the situation is. Once we do that, we have, and we're taping all this in by way of video, so we're taping the actual first contact interview, and then after the interview, then we would, our investigators would proceed by performing a demonic investigation, and that would be of the premises, the house, place, location, and also interview the people in the household. And once that's done, they put together what we refer to as a full assessment report, which is submitted to my office. Now, if there was a question about someone being possibly showing signs of demonic possession, then we would request from the family to have their family physician contact us, send us their medical records as well as the psychological records, and then our physicians would review those, and that would be part of some of the evidence that would be submitted.
I got you.
Along with other things
yeah.
that we would count as the physical manifestation.
So give me a for instance, a case study, if you could.
Okay, someone who is who's contacted us, and we get requests from around the world. Someone who's contacted us, perhaps a family member, stating that their child or brother or sister is showing strange signs or strange behaviors, and as such, almost roaming in the supernatural realm, if you will. And as a result, they would like us to investigate. We would send our investigators to the premises, to the location. They would conduct the face-to-face interview. We have over 60 questions we would direct to the individual in regards to the mental changes or the physical changes or even the outward manifestations that they have witnessed.
Right. No, I understand. What I'm saying is, can you actually give us some of the details from an actual case without obviously identifying the individuals involved?
I could give you several cases.
All right, okay? let's do that.
And one of the cases I'd like to tell you the story. It was regards to yours truly. I've almost lost my life the earlier part of last year in regards to a ritual that was being performed. And so if I may, I could go into this.
Yeah, let's at least begin that conversation. We've got about 7-8 minutes here before the break, and then if we need more time, we'll continue on the other side. Let's begin.
Okay, well, let's start with the, we were called. Apparently, there was an individual suspected of having symptoms of the traditional symptoms of demonic possession. And so we were called to the premises. We arrived with a team of investigators as well as clergy. There was about 9 of us. As we entered the premises and we conducted the interview, I could remember smelling a terrible stench. And then the sounds started coming in. And then some of the banging sounds in the walls and you know, and it's all the things that you may have seen in the movies. A lot of this stuff is actually real or can actually happen. And then after that, a very strong wind, like a breeze that went throughout the entire house. And the doors and windows are closed, of course, but you could feel this breeze and sense a heaviness in the air was just so heavy.
And the victim, a young boy, young girl?
The child was about 14 years old. 14, 15 years old, has had some psychological problems, was on medication, but that was one side of the profile. What was unusual were the other things that took place, the physical manifestations, as I mentioned, the odors, and even the temperature in the room would drop, strong wind. These are other physical manifestations that would be that would coexist with the person who may be demonstrating symptoms of possession. As I was reading the series of prayers, and I was in the center of the room, I felt what appeared to be an invisible 2x4. It struck me 3 times on my left side, and I remember buckling over. The pain was incredible, and again, this was done by a totally invisible force, an invisible entity.
Was the girl? Was she
the boy?
The boy. Sorry, was this individual on a bed, tied to the bed?
This individual was in the bed, was laying in a bed, and the room was filled with people. We had, as I said, 8 or 9 people that were present.
How did he look?
He looked like he was in a deep state. of sleep. He was as he was sleeping through the whole process. He didn't move. He just stood as he was solid frozen in just that one area. And so as a result, you can see the discoloration in his face. In cases like this, their hair and eyes even change colors. In this case, he was breathing heavy. His complexion was very pasty, very cold to the touch. And at this point, he wasn't saying anything. His eyes were closed, and he was just laying there. And as he was doing this, you know, we were going through the ritual. I had an assistant who was reading the responses. And as a result, when this all took place, and I physically was attacked at this point, a week later, after we have left the premises, I had to go to the hospital, and only to find out that I had a 2-liter sack of blood around my heart, and I had 3 surgeries, I had 3 operations, and I was in intensive care for over 30 days.
Oh my! This is a result. This is a result of being attacked by an invisible entity in the room.
Exactly, as a direct result of encountering this demonic entity. To this day, the physicians that were attending me have no idea as to how I reached that condition.
Was there any bruising on your body?
No, there was no bruising. There was no. Bruising whatsoever. I had at least a half a dozen CAT scans, chest x-rays, blood tests, you know, through the whole 9 yards. They couldn't come up with a reason as to what had taken place.
That's astounding.
A similar thing happened most recently when I, one of the things that I do is I review assessments, and I'm sitting in front of my computer, and I have members in our organization that would send me a video feed in regards to what has taken place. You know, we have members in third world countries that will send me information, and I'm viewing this on the screen, and this happened most recently. This happened a couple of weeks ago. And what I was actually witnessing was real demonic activity going on, and as I'm viewing this, something happened where I felt myself being pushed back from my computer. And when I lifted my shirt, I did have a bruise. That was the shape of a palm. And that same day, I did go back to the same hospital. And they went, they gave me a CAT scan, chest x-ray, and blood test, the whole 9 yards. And again, there was no reason as to why that imprint was on my side.
Back to the 14-year-old boy in the bed. Walk us through what else you saw in that room. I mean, was there levitation at any point? Did the child wake up and speak in another language?
What actually took place? Okay, after I was struck, I continued with the prayers, and an exorcism ritual is a series of prayers in a repetitious fashion. At one point, he opened his eyes. His eyes were a solid color, and as a result, the rhythm of his breathing became very rapid. And at that point, we had him basically tied down to the bed frame of the bed. The reason for this is there have been many cases where the victim can actually levitate, and this has been seen by many people who are in my kind of ministry. That thing actually takes place. So to prevent that from happening or any other aggression, we tie the individual down to whether it be a bed frame or something, or tie his hands and feet. And it sounds very barbaric, but there's a reason for this. The person can come up, he can strike, he could physically attack people in the room. And for our own safety, the person has to be bound and tied somewhere and remain stationary as we perform and continue to perform a ritual. At this point, heavy breathing happened and started spitting a lot. it's amazing in terms of his accuracy. He could spit across the room and hit somebody in the eye. It was just amazing. And at that point, he started growling very loud. And as a result, we continued our prayers. And at that point, we asked him to identify himself. That is the demon. This is part of what the ritual and how the ritual takes place. We have to identify the demon. And once we know the name of the demon, then we could call the demon out. And through, again, through a series of prayers, we could command the demon to leave the person.
All right. We've got the music percolating up here, Archbishop. Just stay where you are. We'll get back together on the other side of this commercial break and continue to delve into this case of a demonic possession and exorcism. Archbishop Ron File, my guest, the chief exorcist for the Sacred Order of St. Michael the Archangel, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. And we are back with Archbishop Ron File from the Sacred Order of St. Michael the Archangel. He is the chief exorcist there. Before we proceed with this case, Archbishop, approximately how many authentic cases of demonic possession have you witnessed?
I've witnessed and been involved in directly. I'd say over a period of 34 years, we're looking at about a couple of thousand.
A couple thousand.
Maybe just over a couple of thousand. Now, this includes demonic infestation.
Right.
Which is another thing, but it's dealing with the demonic, and it's very serious.
And this is a couple of thousand after you've – these are the what you would call the authentic cases after you've dismissed the others as not authentic.
That's exactly right. I mean, all in all, we've probably had maybe – and I'm just guessing off the top of my head, we probably had 10,000 requests over 34 years, and out of the 10,000, maybe 2,000, we actually felt a need to get directly involved. And it's because we have a process. The process is down. It's a systematic process where we could basically rule out if it's just a total psychosis, we could rule out individuals that may be suffering mentally, or we could rule out people who are just seeking attention.
Right.
And I mean, you know, the list goes on in regards to cases that would not be valid.
Right.
To be a valid case, it would take us about 3 months to process the assessment and have a good, solid support case of demonic possession. We have to make sure that it's a genuine case before we proceed.
This is a thorough investigation for 3 months. Now, does it ever get easier in terms of, I mean, I'm guessing you must be absolutely scared out of your mind when you witness something like this. Does that ever go away, or?
Every case is totally different. One of the most dramatic cases that I've been on and I've witnessed is actually seeing the demonic having an actual physical head come through the wall. And again, you know, a lot of this stuff has never really been publicized because, let's face it, it sounds crazy. And as a result, there are a lot of churches that will shy away from these kinds of ministries because of the various allegations that could be tied to their ministry. When things happen like this, it changes you. People who are involved as our investigators, for example, once they are on their first demonic investigation and they witness the demonic firsthand, their whole perspective and belief system is altered. And as a result, they look at life differently.
I can imagine. All right, back to this case. This 14-year-old boy, restrained, was the demon identified? Did he speak the name?
Yes. Yeah. There's a few things before that.
Okay.
Okay, and I'll elaborate a little bit on that. He's laying down, and he looks like he's extremely rigid. He's tied down. His eyes are totally dilated. His breathing is extremely heavy. He starts. Screaming is not the right word. I think it's growling would be. It's between growling and screaming. It's an extremely loud sound that you could probably hear a block away. The the sound was so loud it rattled the windows in the room. It was almost deafening, and it was just not a scream. It was it's such a blast. It's hard to articulate in regards to exactly what or what to compare it with. In any case, it was so loud and deafening that the individual that was standing next to me had to leave the room because the sound was so intense. Then, again, after that period, it seemed like the sound went on for an hour, but in reality, it was just a few minutes. It seems like time just basically put us in a state where everything was a slow motion pace, if you will. And it's what it is, basically, it's a psychological thing. We're all taking all of this in simultaneously, not only visually, but orderly. We're witnessing everything, and it seems like for the first time. Every case is totally different, but every once in a while, there are a few things that are very similar. And one of the things that I could say would be the pitch, the voice of the individual who's possessed. Sometimes you will hear two or three or four voices come out simultaneously at the same time. High pitches, low pitches. We have recorded such things where the voice pitch, as you know, your verbal pitch has a certain sound, certain a rhythm to it, if you will.
Right, and a timbre.
When you have two, three, four voices at one time, it's like a chorus of voices. And so the pitch level is high, low, and as a result, and I'm sure you're familiar with the electronic equipment that's available where you could actually tape the voice patterns of the sounds. It's quite remarkable.
And do you record these?
Yeah.
You document these?
We recorded, we do this in terms of just reviewing in terms of our assessments, and this is part of the evidence to support a case. And if we have enough of that evidence, then of course we can, we can give the green light to have a ritual actually performed.
We are coming up on another break here, but let me just ask you a couple of quick questions. Did this entity speak to you directly?
Oh, yes.
What did it say?
It's a series of profanities, which I don't know if you'd want me to repeat those.
No, not necessary. I think we get the drift.
But let's see how I could put this. Something to the effect that we should get out, and that we're worthless, and what we're trying to do will not be effective, and that the body of the person that this entity was inhabiting was claiming it to be its own property, and therefore we have no right to it. And in essence, and I've really cleaned that up.
Yes, I can imagine. All right, listen, Archbishop, stay put. We'll come back in just a few moments and continue to discuss demonic possession and exorcisms. Archbishop Ron File, the Sacred Order of St. Michael the Archangel, here on The Conspiracy Show. It's frustrating sometimes, Archbishop. I really need like 3 hours to drill down seriously into this topic, but I have but the one. So let me race ahead here a little bit. Did the victim, this 14-year-old boy, the victim of this demonic possession, did he demonstrate certain abilities, for example, either before the rite of exorcism or during the interview or the questioning, did he ever demonstrate certain abilities, abnormal abilities, superhuman strength, psychic abilities, things like that?
He spoke to one of the investigators who was present and identified him by name and said something to the effect that he should be ashamed of himself because of the affair he's having with his business partner. And his wife knows nothing about it, and identified him as a pig, and said and told him some various other things that were of personal nature that no one in the room had no idea, and that was pretty shaking.
Yeah, I guess.
All in all, while all of this is happening, there are things happening in the room. There are things moving in the room. There are things, literally, you could feel the walls. If you were to place your hands on the walls, you would feel the vibrations on the walls, like almost a wavery type of movement. That wasn't actually happening, but if you were to put your hands on the walls, that's exactly what you would have felt. There were things happening in the room while he was conscious and while he was speaking. Things would happen, and it was very nerve-wracking, to say the least. To make a long story short, I believe it was 3 days, and this was 3 days. This is like 6 hours a day. I think the first day was about 9 or 10, and then it was 6 hours after that, and the following day was 6 hours. The demon finally revealed his name, and as a result, we were able to connect with that demon and command the demon to leave the body of this young boy. And it was an interesting experience. All the people in the room claim that they felt something. They felt something like more than just the hair on the back of their neck stand up. They felt like if they're being pushed or having problems breathing, or the air was so thick that they were out of breath when they left the room. Each person had their own personal experience as to what took place. And as a result, there were 3 or 4 people that were present. As I said, there was about 8 or 9 of us in the room. 3 or 4 people stated that they did not see exactly what happened at the very end, and yet they were only standing a few feet away. It was as if they just went blank for a split second. And whatever took place, it just didn't play back in their memory as a result. And again, these are things that are not general known facts that may occur in a ritual such as this.
Now, this took 3 days, or parts of 3 days.
Yes.
Is there an average amount of time that it takes to exorcise someone? Can it take just one time? Can it take sometimes dozens of times?
I've worked on cases that have taken a couple of years.
Oh,
and I've also worked on cases that have only taken one afternoon. It just depends. If you're talking about a multiple possession where there are multiple demons that are possessing the individual.
We are legion.
That poor individual is being tormented, and you could see he's being torn from inside out. I mean, it's such a horrible thing to witness. But if the person has multiple demons, then whoever is the lead priest performing the actual ritual, he will have to identify each demon, and it could take a long time. It could take 6 months. It could take a year. It could take, as I said, the one case took over just over 2 years.
Oh my! Is this a full time
going back and repeating the same prayers?
Yes.
In repetition fashion.
Is this full time for you? I mean, is there any time for anything else?
I wish there was.
This is full time.
I work about 7 days a week, and but understand, okay, I have over 60 members. I think we're up to 65 members now, who are clergy and investigators, and they're out there. They're working the cases. They're doing assessments. They're performing rituals, things of this nature. They're sending their assessments back to me. I make a final determination as to whether or not we have enough information and enough evidence to support a case. And this is after reviewing the medical, psychological, and then the physical evidence that our investigators would submit.
Where do these demons go once they're exorcised?
I can tell you where they're not. And they're not in the person. They exit the person. The person becomes cheerful, becomes as he would appear before he was possessed. And in most cases, you could smell roses. There's a sweetness in the room, and the whole demeanor of the whole experience by the individual and all the family members, it transforms into a very happy occasion, and then you know that the demonic is no longer present.
And what happened to this 14-year-old boy? Now is he now leading a normal life?
He's living a normal life. Yes, I still believe he's on medication though. but he's not experiencing the supernatural things that were occurring at the same time as he was on medication. He's still on medication.
Do demons? Archbishop. Do demons select as their victims individuals that have some underlying mental issue because that will mask the possession and people won't believe that they are actually possessed?
At times, in fact, this is an excellent issue. When we have people who make a request for our services, and if they claim to be possessed by a demonic, the first thing that comes to mind is a red flag, because the demonic would not want anyone to know that they're present. Their whole purpose is to wear a person down, not kill that person, but push that person to a state where that person would want to commit suicide, make their life so miserable, the physical pain, the mental anguish, everything. And then demonic oppression can slide into demonic possession. When that happens, it's a complete takeover of body and mind. And as a result, the personality of that demon will surface within that body. And then what you'll see is self-destruction. You will see self-mutilation. You will see things that that would be so horrifying, and it would probably create nightmares for a year, just trying to forget about what you have actually witnessed. These things are real, and as a result, they're also very private. This is a very private issue among the family members and family units that have these form of problems. It's something that's not really publicized, per se. One of the main reasons I even agreed to come on your show, and I do interviews like this, is to let people know that we exist, and they could come to us if they have any problems in regards to the demonic.
And how do they get a hold of you?
We have a couple of websites, and all our members have websites as well. But our main websites are orderofexorcist.com and orderofexorcist.weebly.com. And they just have to hit the contact page, give us as much detail as possible, tell us what city, state, and country they're located in. And
you will travel to them? You will travel to them? No.
Well, we have members in 24 countries.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And we're across the country. We're across the United States as well. We have some in Canada. We have some in Poland. We have some in UK. We have members all over who are clergy and investigators.
How are you funded?
We are a nonprofit organization, and we seek no money. All our services are free. All our investigators and clergy, they do it because they have a calling from God, and therefore everything we do is absolutely free. Of course, we accept donations, and when they come in, that's a blessing, but we know we don't seek donations. We seek the blessings from God, and God gives us the ability to do what we do.
All right, let's spend the final moments talking about how someone becomes possessed. Let's talk about how one might open a portal or a door or okay. Welcome one of these entities into their lives.
Okay, I'll try to make this real quick because I know you're short on time. Okay, first of all, we're all targets, every one of us. If you're breathing oxygen, if you're walking the earth, you are a target to the demonic. Everyone is a target. The demonic's nature is to attack us, and they will do this through invitation. I would say stay away from Ouija boards. I'd say stay away from other things that may open your mind and your willingness to interact with an invisible entity. The demonic will disguise itself as an angel of light. In reality, it's just waiting for you to invite it in. And once it does that, demonic oppression, the main entry point is the mind. Once it's in the mind, it will torment that individual, wear that person down, and perhaps even fall into a full possession.
So one should avoid, let's say, for example, attempting to communicate with relatives that have passed on, for example,
right.
Seeing a medium.
Stay away from channelers. Stay away from Ouija boards. Stay away from seances. Stay away from anything that would open a doorway for the demonic to come in. The demonic will only come in through personal invitation, and because of the internet and through our modern technology, demonic influence is all around us, and as a result, it's so easy for anyone. In fact, I would dare to say that in the lifespan of a normal person, they will be touched by the demonic at least once. And if they're terribly unlucky, many times.
Have you ever come across a case where the individual was too far gone, there was nothing you could do for them?
The boundaries of God's power is unlimited. It is more powerful than Satan's powers. So as a result, any person who can be saved will be saved through the power of God. There are no limits. It could be done. Now, understand, the person who is possessed has to also have a willingness to want to be saved, who may want to become well again. They have to have that inner survival instinct. If they don't have that, then there's no way for us to get to them and to save them.
All right, Archbishop, listen, leave us with the websites again for people who need to get in touch with you.
Okay, well, our main website is orderofexorcist.com. Just use the contact page, give us as much detail, state, country you're in, and your details, and we will get to you.
And again, you have members in Canada, in the Toronto area?
Yes, we do, actually.
All right, and you're working 7 days a week, round the clock. Well, I really appreciate you spending some time with us, Archbishop, and perhaps we can talk again.
It would be my pleasure, and I thank you very much for having me on.
All right, God bless you, sir.
You too.
Archbishop Ron File, who is the chief exorcist from the Sacred Order of St. Michael the Archangel, orderofexorcists.com is the best way to get in touch with them. My website, again, www.richardserrett.com. That's your portal to this radio program. And again, don't forget the website for the TV show, Season 3, theconspiracyshow.com. Great website, very proud of it. Season 3 begins August 11th, 10 p.m. Eastern across Canada on Vision TV. In the meantime, follow the truth. Well, you found us. This is The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett, and thanks for inviting me into your home, and thank you, most of all, for your ears. I'm a little out of breath. During breaks, I'm just running down the hall to the boardroom to check on my little guys. My twin boys are camping out here with me tonight. Every so often, I like to bring them down to the radio station so they can see where the old man works, and they're having a great time. They're just about asleep, so I'm going to race down there again in about 14 minutes just to make sure all is quiet. Hey, wanted to let you know, next Saturday night, I'll be filling in as a guest on Coast to Coast AM once again. And I hope you'll have an opportunity to join me wherever you are. R. Gary Patterson, rock and roll investigator R. Gary Patterson, will be with me on that night to discuss the 45th anniversary of Woodstock, 45 years ago this month. And we'll talk about the strange circumstances surrounding the death of the man who closed the Woodstock Art and Music Festival, of course, Jimi Hendrix. Some suggest there may have been foul play involved there. We'll talk about that. Among others, maybe we'll discuss Jim Morrison, John Lennon, and much, much more. R. Gary Patterson. Now, in the first hour of the Coast to Coast AM broadcast, I'll be speaking with the author of a brand new study on telephone calls from the dead. And this is a real amazing report, because some of the evidence suggests that there may be something to this phenomenon. Telephone calls from the dead. That's all part of Coast to Coast AM when I sit in on Saturday, August the 9th. Hope you'll join me for something else. It's called Follow the Truth, the Conspiracy Show Summit, on Sunday, November the 16th at the Regent Theater. I'm going to be hosting this all-day conference-style event with six incredible speakers. Don Schmidt, Roswell investigator. Jim Penniston, witness to the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident. Professor Ron Mallett on time travel. Patty Greer on crop circles. Jim Elvidge, author of The Universe Solved, will be talking about whether or not we're living in a matrix. Richard Dewhurst will be talking about ancient giants who ruled America. More details and ticket info at www.followthetruth.tv. For the last several months, I have been inundated with tweets and emails from listeners wanting me to do a program about Bigfoot. And I promised I would do that. And typically, when I do a show about Sasquatch, I end up speaking to someone from the Northwest, British Columbia, Washington State, Oregon, California. In fact, when I did a television show on Bigfoot, an episode, we went out to California. Because we tend to think that Sasquatch only dwells in the rainforests of the Pacific Northwest, and that's simply not the case. There have been sightings of Bigfoot in all 50 states, including Rhode Island, if you can believe it, and all 10 provinces, including the province of Ontario, from where this program is emanating. Ontario lists close to, I think it's nearing 100 sightings now, from as far back as 1906. There was one in Cobalt, Ontario. And in 2010, in Lake Superior Provincial Park. Each case is sort of quasi-scientifically investigated. The site operators interview witnesses where possible. Some sightings are obviously weak cases for the Sasquatch's existence. There are people who claim they've heard Sasquatch rather than actual sighting. Others are, well, I guess up to the reader to decide. More recently, I believe it was June of this year. At least that's when the story and the video was posted. It was stamped June 2014. A gentleman by the name of Tim Everick of the Ontario Wildlife Field Research, Ontario, Bigfoot. I believe there was an image of what they think may have been a Sasquatch captured on a GoPro video camera. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But in southern Ontario, there have been three fairly recent sightings in Dundalk, Ontario. Back in 1987, Markdale, Ontario, in 1995, and St. Thomas in 2007. And the latter Bigfoot sighting was on the Elgin Trail, and it's perhaps the most convincing. Now, I mentioned the Ontario Wildlife Field Research Ontario Bigfoot Group, and I have one of its members on the line with me now. Christine Burns is a member of the aforementioned Ontario Wildlife Field Research Ontario Bigfoot Group. She's had a long career as a registered nurse. She's also a holistic health practitioner who has studied under Ojibwa healers. She had her first face-to-face Bigfoot encounter when she was approximately 10 years old in a wooded area in South Porcupine, Ontario. Her first Bigfoot tracking expedition was in 2012 on Vancouver Island, where she and her late husband became educated in Bigfoot habitat, behaviors, tracking, casting, and evidence collection. Christine Burns, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Well, I'm good. And I'm very impressed with what you've already researched. I hope I can add to a lot of that.
Well, yeah, I'm fascinated by a Sasquatch. Never have come close to a sighting. I've done a number of shows on it, a little bit of research, but I am absolutely fascinated by it. And obviously my listeners are, because as I say, they've been letting me know they've wanted me to do a show about this for some time, and it's been a while. So here we go. Let's go back. Let's dial it back to South Porcupine when you were 10 years old. Walk us through what happened, Christine.
Well, I always used to the wooded area was very close to where I lived. It was only a block or two away, and as kids we always went up and played in that area where, you know, we'd find raspberry canes and blueberries and do kids what kids do. So I was never really afraid of going into the bush by myself. I mean, at that time, we didn't have all the warnings about bears. I can remember my mother, you know, if a bear came in the yard, we'd go out with a broom, you know, and so there was no really nothing that really kept us from, like, going up there if we were, say, on our own and meet up as with pals. So I happened to know that the time of the year that I was up there, there was raspberry canes, and that's what I went up to collect. So what happened when I was there was new houses that had built along that that stretch of road called Legion Drive, and a lot of that time the bush was just pushed back, so there was a lot of ridges and kind of gullies back there where they had just dumped the brush area, and that's where the raspberry canes would grow. So I was picking raspberries and reaching my hand through the bushes while I was a bit on an angle, and as I put my hand up to reach in and grab some of these berries, two hands came out, and there I was face to face with something that I never imagined I would ever see. I fell backwards kind of off of the thing, and I can remember the face is still very vivid in my memory, and I remember running like hell back home. And I knew instinctively that no one would really believe me. I knew this wasn't some person in the bush. I knew it was not a bear. Very schooled at knowing what a bear looks like.
What, walk me through, what did it look like exactly?
You know what? It was long hair that I remembered that. I remember the hands having some hair, but they were very, very huge hands. And what I remember the most was kind of the way it was staring at me in as much wonderment as I seemed to be staring at it. There was almost like a facial expression of frowning and looking at me. I remember the nose very more human-like and not a gorilla, not flat and squashed like you see them, you know, the pictures we see of gorillas. But I remember the most part was like the eyes were like a hazel-like eyes. I've read since then that, you know, they kind of are supposed to, in the dark, will have a red glow. But I just remember so much that they were of a light hazel color.
And what color was, excuse me, Christine, I'm sorry, what color was the hair?
The hair was reddish and dark. It was almost like a lighter across the top of the head that came down. And I remember very much seeing like straggly hair hanging on what I could see of the neck and shoulder, which wasn't much. Whether this animal was on the other side of a hump or whether it was down, kneeling down to look at me, I don't know. I just know that it looked wild. It looked wild, but it also looked human-like.
So we're talking about hair, long hair, not fur.
No, to me it was like you would hair hanging in long strings, and some almost curly, but definitely lighter on the upper part towards the shoulder, looked darker. Now that could have been from the shading and the shadowing as well.
And was this creature, was it bent over? I mean, were you looking, was it hunched over? You were looking straight into its eyes, or were you looking up at it?
I was at an angle kind of up at it. So when it looked at me, it was kind of like, it was definitely, the face was higher than mine, but it kind of angled down to look at me, like inquisitive. To me, when I think back on it, I would think the animal must have crouched down to look at me. That's the only impression I can get because, I mean, as a child, I was just locked on the face. I was locked on the face, and the details of covered by the hands coming through the raspberry canes were obviously showing that it was down at some kind of level.
Any idea how large this creature was?
Oh, the head was very large,
How tall? Any idea?
No, I couldn't estimate even as a child. Even now, I can very much picture the face, but any other details are kind of not within my scope of remembering at that kind of stage. The hands, though, were large. There were fingernails, and the skin too was not necessarily dark or blackish. It was more like more like the redness and of a burnished brown.
Right. And any way of identifying whether this may have been a male or female?
No. I remember as I ran away, thinking, nobody's going to believe me. And so there was this sense, and I know now from reading, there's a sense of the fact that people often don't remember what they've actually seen. It's almost like the Seminole Indians believe that they are capable of causing a type of memory loss. This might be related to the fact that there's been much discussion about them using infrasound.
All right, listen, Christine, I hate to interrupt. I've got to take a quick break. We'll come back. Yep. Christine Burns talks about her Bigfoot encounter here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away. All right, little guys are tucked in and finally asleep, I think, down the hall, so we can resume our conversation with Christine Burns, who is revealing or detailing her encounter, her close-up, face-to-face encounter with a Bigfoot in South Porcupine, Ontario. Where is South Porcupine, for those not in the know, Christine?
Northern Ontario. It's now part of the Timmins city limits.
Timmins. Okay, that fixes it in my mind. And I think actually during a family vacation, we rolled through South Porcupine at a certain point. Now, I know better than to ask people how old, women how old they are, but I'm doing the math. I know you graduated from nursing in 1972. This happened when you were about 10. So we're talking about the early 60s.
Yes.
Now, you've heard this a million times, Christine, but for the record, you know, people are going to say, that was 50 years ago, Christine. The mind can play a lot of tricks. How do you know you saw what you saw and that you're not remembering a dream or something like that?
Well, I would have to say that when you experience something like that as closely as I did, it imprints, right? I want to say that, we're all attracted to the mystery of the Sasquatch or Bigfoot, right? I mean, let's face it, he's the monster that lives in our backyard, and we have lots of backyards in our country. There's truth in the fact that people have had these experiences just like mine, but they don't come forward. And I didn't come forward as a child. I instinctively knew that if I was to say that I had seen, say I would have quoted a gorilla in the bush, I mean, nobody would have paid any attention and there's always, even a child is afraid of ridicule. And we find this now even in adults that have had experiences. They won't, they mention it and obviously people, have this attitude of dismissing what they've seen. So, as the Ontario Wildlife Field research people, we face the problem that people will report to us, but we always keep everything totally confidential. There's we want to take reports because we want to track sightings. I think that if I could use Algonquin Park, there have been 200 sightings. Now, those have been reported in some way or form or video or by mention.
200 sightings in the provincial park alone?
Yes, there's been 200 sightings in Algonquin Park. It's a perfect environment. It's over 7,630 square kilometers. The interior is only accessible by canoe. There's coniferous and deciduous forests. It's the climate. There's a great analogy that we can make now between areas where there are Sasquatch sightings and the amount of precipitation that's received in that area.
Interesting. Listen, I want to come back to Algonquin in a moment, but I just stay. I want to stay with your sighting for just a few more moments.
Okay.
Was this creature, did it appear to be menacing at all?
I think I've really got the impression when I see the face movement that it was looking at me, maybe trying to figure out who I was or what I was. I was small, blonde-haired, There has been reports that that there's a preference to blondes, that a lot of blondes have had sightings. I don't believe this animal shows itself. It's known as being sneaky. I don't think it shows itself unless it wants to view what's on the other, what its perception is trying to form. This this could have been a young Bigfoot, and just as curious to see me.
Sure.
And that's quite logical.
Did you even know what Sasquatch was at that point? Had you heard stories about Sasquatch?
Never. I didn't. I knew that I had seen something that looked like a gorilla, but wasn't a gorilla. It wasn't a wild man living in the bush, you know, an old prospector or anything like this. It was definitely, to me, it was an animal that looked like a man in many ways.
And you had you were able to get up and run. I mean, many people may have been paralyzed by fear, but you got up and you made your escape.
Yeah.
And when you
fell backwards, mm-hmm. and some of that I can't remember. I do remember watching my feet running because I didn't want to trip and fall. In my mind, it was like if I fell, I wasn't being chased. I was just running from my own fear.
It didn't pursue you?
No.
So you got home, and what happened? You just you stayed quiet and told not nary a soul for years and years and years.
No, I think it's like when I talk about the mystery of the Sasquatch. It's like it's the monster in our backyard. You know, children don't start. We don't start telling stories about monsters under our beds. And to me, at that time, I just felt like that not discussing it didn't give any reality to that monster that's out in the bush.
When were you able to connect the dots? Did you see a movie, read a book about Sasquatch, and say, "Bingo, that's what I saw"?
I guess I was probably in my teens or whatever, and there was many things around the Patterson Gimlet.
The Patterson Gimlet, yeah, sure.
Yes, and Gimlin, yes, and so that was really quite. Public, and then I felt kind of validated that, like, you know, that I saw does exist. And when there was all the controversy over whether it was you know, staged or whatever, I knew instinctively, I know that can't be staged. And then of course there was the movie that was about Harry and the Hendersons, or
right,
whatever.
Right.
And all that, and I just felt that no, this at the time I said animal, I know exists. I've had my own experience. I didn't really need it to feel that I had to share it with anybody, because what was the point? As you said, I was like 10. Somebody can easily say, well, you don't remember, or it's something that you dreamed. But the Patterson Gimlin film, you know, to me right away I knew, no, that must have been what I saw. That's what must have been looking at
right.
me.
Right. Now you graduated from nursing in 72 and had a long nursing career. You married a police officer from North Bay.
Yeah.
At what point? Because I know that you and your late husband traveled out to Vancouver Island and you went on your first Bigfoot expedition, but only a couple years ago. At what point did you decide, I have to do something with this? I had this face-to-face encounter. Was it always in the back of your mind that you were going to pursue this?
Not until my son, after his military career, was posted out to Vancouver Island, and that's where he retired, and he found out that the area that he lives in, Comox Courtney, there's been a lot of Bigfoot activity, Sasquatch. And he started talking to me about it, and he said that he was wanting to go on a Bigfoot expedition, and that he thought that it would be wonderful for David and I, my husband and I, to go out there as a retirement gift, and he would, you know, pay for us to go on this expedition. And that's when I shared with, I had shared with my son that I had an experience, because he was reading an awful lot about Vancouver Island and the BC and the Pacific Coast, and so when he knew that I had had a childhood experience, that's what popped into his mind, is, well, let's go. And my son now is an investigator for the RFO. He's really enjoying his. It's not a hobby. It's he's quite engrossed in this, and so that's why I've gone again, an expedition in 2013 and in 2014. I go for the education. I would have to say that I am a hands-on investigator. I like going out. I like looking for signs, you know, stick structures. I would love to find a footprint, hair samples. That's what intrigues me, is being out there in the environment. And we have the environment right here in Ontario. We have the same ability to find more of the evidence of, and hopefully someday the scientific community will accept that the Bigfoot exists. We have footprints, we have handprints, we have fingerprints, we have hair samples. The only thing that's lacking is a body, and any of us who do investigate Bigfoot, that's something maybe that we really don't want to have happen in a strange way.
Well, you said something interesting in your bio that you sent me. You said, I don't want to find Bigfoot. I want Bigfoot to find me. What do you mean by that?
There's an Ojibwe belief that and I feel that as well, that it's a spirit animal, and that if you have the right intention, it will show itself. And I believe that really and truly. I don't want it to learn from human investigation that we're trying to encroach on it, or that we're trying to harm it. So I believe that, and I've met many other investigators feel that way too, that when we're out and we're walking the mountain roads and trails at night, and we're doing calling and wood knocks and screams, we're trying to have the Sasquatch see us and come into our, say, our base camp, or follow us to look at what we're doing. Why are we trying to behave like them? What's the connection?
When you say that it is a spirit animal, I mean, what does that mean exactly? Are we talking about maybe a creature that may exist in more than one dimension at one time? For example, I have heard from certain Bigfoot trackers that they have tracked footprints into the woods, let's say in the snow, for example, and the footprints suddenly stop. They don't go anywhere, which might suggest maybe this creature left this dimension and kept walking into another dimension. I don't know. I don't want to get too woo-woo here, but I mean, what that sort of seems to be the logical extension of what a spirit animal might be. What are your thoughts?
Well, I've had one investigator actually state that, and she works in the forest industry, that she actually had a full sighting of a Sasquatch. And as she looked at it, it suddenly disappeared. I call it ghosting. We don't know what capabilities these animals have. We do feel that they see infrared. That's why recorders for trail cams don't work. There's many humans that can see infrared as well. So they avoid the cameras, the infrared. We also know that they can do what I've said before, infrasound. They believe that it's kind of I know that the tiger is being studied for that. Their roar is able to make someone freeze and actually have even a memory loss because of the shock and the vibrations. So do we really know? I mean, I know that the natives don't talk about them necessarily disappearing. But as I said before, the Seminole Indians believe that they are able to give us the ability to forget due to a hypnotic effect that they have. And that, again, relates to the infrasound that is capable of predators.
We're coming up on a break here, Christine. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about your investigations, your expeditions to Vancouver Island with your son and your late husband. Am I correct?
Yeah.
You lost your husband. Now, he was a criminal investigator, and you also mentioned something in your bio that here he is, a criminal investigator. It's all about the evidence for him. Your husband, late husband, sounded like sort of a no-nonsense guy, yet he was convinced by the available evidence that if you had to stand up in court, you could prove the existence of Bigfoot. Is that correct?
That's correct. He was a forensic science, a tech, and also a criminal investigator. And when he went out, quite honestly, in our first expedition, he was skeptical. But seeing and visualizing the evidence that the investigators out there presented to us, and through education and actual pictures and whatever, my husband stated that in a court of law, if he presented the evidence that is out there, a court of law would have to come with a verdict that Sasquatch exists.
All right, Christine, hold on. Christine Burns from the Ontario Wildlife Field Research Ontario Bigfoot Group, back with more of The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. And say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. Christine Burns is with us. She had her first face-to-face Bigfoot encounter when she was approximately 10 years old in a wooded area in South Porcupine, Ontario. That's up near Timmins. And her first Bigfoot tracking expedition was in 2012 on Vancouver Island, where she and her late husband became educated in Bigfoot habitat, behaviors, tracking, casting, and evidence collection. Did any of your expeditions out to Vancouver Island yielded any significant evidence, video, photography, audio recordings, anything like that, Christine?
My first expedition, when we were out there, we were learning how to do screaming or calling, and we actually had a response. The second expedition that I went on, we seemed to have a lot of activity at night for the group. We felt like there's also a sense of, well, I should mention this, there's also a sense of feeling that you know that something's around. It's a very, for us, it's a very instinctual thing, you know. And when we were all as a group at our base camp, the kind of formulating the last of our investigative skills and what we had been researching, we were all sitting around, and a tree was felled right behind us, just pushed down. We immediately froze because that's one of the things that, you know, if you've seen any of YouTubes or whatever, often a tree will get pushed over. It's almost like a warning.
Yes, yes.
And we all kind of froze. And then, as we all know, you don't want to all rush because you don't want to destroy any evidence. So the primary investigators went up, marked the area for looking for any prints and that, and I didn't myself go up. It was like on a slope of the land. We were near a lake edge, so it was up on the slope, and I'm sure that was recorded as that something had come down towards our base camp and more or less giving us the the warning.
You mentioned their calls. So you put out a call?
So what we do is we break up into groups, and we find a valley or a long ridge line or whatever, and then we the investigators scout out the area that we're going to set up a base camp. We only get the longitude and latitude of where we're going just before we leave for the expedition. That's so that we can prevent anybody, eliminate any hoaxing or anything not done by any of the investigators going in there, but just for the sake of that we're trying to keep this as a pure investigation as we can. So we go up onto the different ridges and we have different groups, and what we decide to do is a female will scream down that valley or ridge line, hoping to get a response. Then we have recorders, and we also wait and listen for them, any responses. And then maybe a male in one of the other groups will do the type of call that would be similar to what a male Sasquatch would make. And so what we're trying to do is actually make any Sasquatch in the area realize that there's a female and a male in their territory. It could be seen as that it could bring responses. We seem to get more responses out of wood knocks, and that has got to be some kind of a messaging system. One thing to be said, you never do one knock. One knock has been recognized as being confrontational, so it's always two knocks, and then we wait for a period of time to see if there's any response. It's amazing when we consider the height that we're of the elevation that we're at, and how far that those screams and those knocks can carry down these areas.
Right, right.
And it will, you know, it's you realize that a lot of the knocks that are responded back are even louder than what we've been able to make as a human. So then you make the assumption that whatever is knocking back is certainly huge.
And very close by, perhaps.
And close by.
Listen, I got to run here. We got another timeout. We'll come back in a few moments and discuss more. Christine Burns is with us, and she is with the Ontario Wildlife Field Research Bigfoot Group. Back with more of the Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. And we've got about another 15 minutes with Christine Burns from the Wildlife Field Research Ontario Bigfoot Group. And Christine, I want to focus on Ontario and perhaps Algonquin for the remainder of the program. I mentioned earlier about this video. It was taken on a GoPro camera up in Algonquin by I'm not sure if the video was taken by Tim Everick. Now, was that June of this year? Do you know?
I know that I've seen a few written reports of that, but I'm not sure if I've actually seen the video or which one it is. I believe it was on a road, if I'm not mistaken, and they were driving along, and then when they looked at it later, they could see that there was a figure standing on the side of the road.
Right, that's the one. That's the one.
The year, I'd have to defer to my administrator who would know for sure.
But as you say, 200 sightings in Algonquin, and these are dating back how long? How far? Do you know?
I believe they're dating back to when the park was the park used to be logged, and there was actually residencies in the park. And then that was changed, I believe, in the 1930s, if I'm mistaken. And so it became more of a park setting. So a lot of the sightings came from back when the park was first used for logging.
When Tommy Thompson was paddling Canoe Lake.
Yeah, probably.
And sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to get back again to that. Like, you know, it's a vast park between Georgian Bay and. The climate is perfect. As I said again, the precipitation is 50 millimeters or more, which is have been correlated to habitat for Sasquatch if the monthly precipitation is above that. And that can be, you can see that on, if you look at the internet. I know that I have recent active areas. In 2002, in Algonquin Park, Cripple Creek, there was a sighting. In 2009, at Rain Lake, and in 2010, I believe was the video. In 2010 there was a cabin on the Algonquin property that had some malevolent activity. And I believe the video that we're talking about now was on a later date, more frequent, more recent. I think that you can find most of that information on the Bigfoot forum if people are interested. I wanted to just mention the Algonquin natives. They acknowledged that there were two types of Bigfoot. The first one was called Genosqua, and it was more prevalent in the east here, and it was known by the natives to be cannibalistic.
Oh my.
Meaning that it was more violent towards men and would abduct them for obviously eating. They described him as a stone man, and that was due to a very, very strong skin that was on this animal. They would try and, kill this animal, and apparently its chest wouldn't puncture. So they called him a stone man, and they related it that the behavior of the Genosqua was he hunts at night and kills by ripping the heads or twisting the neck. So often deer are found with their necks twisted right round.
Oh, Christine, I almost wish I hadn't heard about that. I was hoping, hope against hope, that these wonderful wild men of the woods are such peaceful creatures, and then you had to totally disabuse me of that.
But they were talking about different temperaments, because I know the Pacific area, they do talk about that they seem that the nature of Sasquatch out there are more benevolent. Now, we aren't finding any Genosqua, people being cannibalized or whatever. So whether it was and we're going back to the Algonquin natives feeling that there was different types. But you know what? I think a lot of things with the Sasquatch or Bigfoot, when there's human encroachment, they move on. So if this type of Sasquatch exists here and is found to be a little more malevolent, and I only say that because we've had cabins that have been had rocks thrown at them and some trashing, but all those things, when that has happened, there's never been any human killings or whatever associated with any of that. It's just more of an aggressive behavior to try and remove the human contact.
So at least two species here in Ontario, I was going to ask you, because I'm sure somebody at some point has sort of contrasted the audio recordings of these of Sasquatches from different parts of North America and found profound differences in the calls, perhaps. Is that something that's been done, do you know?
Yeah, I believe that I'm not so sure about the calls. I know that my experience is, of course, that the calls are similar here as out west. But there seems to be more of a difference in maybe the amount of hair as maybe the tracks and the feet are the same size. They're anywhere to 18, 20 inches. The definite, by the depression that the print makes, we know that they're like 500-600 pounds. So there's a great similarity, but around the world, of course, we see the difference in, the Yeti, the swamp ape in Florida, there just seems to be an adaptation, I believe, to the environment.
I was just thinking back to that rather chilling description you mentioned of the cannibalistic species, I don't know what to call them, not a species, but the cannibalistic Bigfoot that the Algonquin Indians described.
Mm-hmm.
And a gentleman who's been on Coast to Coast a number of times, David Paulides, who wrote a book called Missing 411, about all these odd disappearances in state parks. And I'm wondering, I'm connecting the dots where I don't really want to connect the dots. I mean, do you think there may be, I'm asking you to speculate here, a connection between Sasquatch and these odd disappearances of people in state parks and maybe even provincial parks?
Personally, yes. I believe there is a definite correlation between the areas of sightings for Sasquatch and the areas of disappearance of people in these parks. I mean, the reality is that that David Paulides has definitely done his homework, and there certainly raises questions. He never in his books, to my knowledge, ever says that they are related to Bigfoot. But if you overlay the map, it's quite impressive.
Well, does this change the way you think about this spirit animal? I mean, all of a sudden now it's a little bit more menacing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I used to go looking for evidence on my own. You know, I canoed and kayaked, and I would go up, you know, little streams and whatever, because I felt if I watched the riverbanks, I might see where there's a trail that, you know, even finding a print. And because we know that that Temagami area is quite an active area. And so, you know, and that's where I camp up in that area. I've given more thought to it now that, you know, gone on expeditions, and they say never go alone. You most certainly should never go alone. And areas that are quite vulnerable or hiking alone, especially in a rugged territory where there's rocks and hills and those kind of places that we know that Sasquatch will probably for game, to catch game, hides in one area, and when the elk or whatever come down through, they grab the legs, they break the legs, and, you know, then the animal can't escape.
These are formidable hunters.
Mm-hmm, they are. And so whether they see us as food, I don't think so, but, I mean, if you wander into their territory, we don't know when and if there's a mating season, when's it most, when would you be most vulnerable to actually, you know, come across an area that they might be nesting or are building their structures. So I have a different thought on it now, but at one time I wouldn't have thought anything about going and looking.
Why are they? You mentioned these structures. I'd like to just pursue that. We only have a few minutes left here, but these structures. What are we talking about? Nests, temporary shelters.
They make structures that that are almost teepee-like. They're quite. There'll be. There's no reason for, say, the tree to have fallen over. There actually might be actually tree limbs from another. Say like an oak or a birch or something that, and they make these structures, and they seem to be making a place for a habitat. I look for those kind of things, and I actually did find something out west that I took a picture of, but they're quite specific. There's evidence of seeing where they take limbs and weave them in amongst. So they'll take a limb and weave it in amongst other trees. Now, that doesn't occur naturally, and it might be 8 feet above the ground. There's also where they've seen a lot of things where they will make twines and look like they're being artistic. They're making some kind of form. There's also a lot of literature about stick structures that they put on the ground. So they definitely are using their environment for habitation. Caves, there's quite a lot of literature about caves and the use of caves.
And any idea how many breeding pairs might be in Algonquin? What would be the minimum in order to sustain a population, given that there have been 200 sightings there? Any idea?
No, I wouldn't. I would believe that Algonquin Park would be a stable environment for them. They wouldn't be migrating. There's lots of discussion about whether they migrate. I don't believe that in the environment that Algonquin Park would provide, that there would be any necessary. I mean, there's plenty of game. There's plenty of water, lakes, and isolation. Why would they move? But I know there was some discussion when I was out west about what a gestation time would be for an animal of that size. And it certainly would be more than a human gestation of 9 months. So, and how much offspring do they have? Most of suggested reports, or there's a video where they only seem to have one child or youth. So, again, the answers would be, how often do they mate? When do they mate? How long is the gestation period? Those are things we don't know, and one day maybe we can do estimate, you know,
yes,
of what it might be.
Christine, listen, I really enjoyed our conversation. I'd love to have you back in the future to talk some more about Sasquatch.
And just keep in mind that the Ontario Wildlife Field Research Group, we're going to be planning in the future, as I've attended out west, we're going to take people out to a base camp and do some investigating, because there's so much interest in this now.
Absolutely. Got to run. But listen, always a real pleasure. Thank you, Christine.
All right, then. Thank you.
Good night. My thanks to Tim Spreen for production. Is my little Zachary around? He wandered out of the boardroom. He woke up. Anyway, I thought he might want to say goodnight. I see his teddy bears over there anyway. Back next week with a brand new show. Hope you'll be along for that. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the rooftops. Do you want to say goodnight, Zachary? Come here, quickly, quickly, quickly.
Good night.
Good night, sweetheart.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.